Welcome to What to Expect When Transitioning from High School to University or College. My name is Sarah Dimmerman, also known as Help Me Sarah, and today I'm in conversation with Brenda Whiteside. Brenda is Associate Vice President, Student Affairs at the University of Guelph in Ontario, which means that she's responsible for the non-academic programs and services for students on campus. This includes athletics, student wellness services, student housing, childcare, student life, co-op and career services, amongst other things. She is also the contact with student leaders, providing oversight of student organizations and clubs and providing support and advice. Brenda herself is a graduate of the University of Guelph, receiving a BA in Management Economics and an MA in Economics. Thanks for joining me today, Brenda.
Oh, I'm happy to.
So I know that you're getting ready for everything to begin at the university right now.
We are.
So I know that this is the peak week where students are feeling potentially very anxious and very excited about what life holds over the next few years. And I think my daughter is entering her grade 12 year, so this will be the year that we're also contemplating which university she will go to next year. So I can only imagine that this podcast will come in very handy for me and her, so I'm planning ahead. So looking at your expertise to give me some guidance and to give my listeners some guidance about how to approach this, both from the parents' perspective and, of course, even more importantly, perhaps from the students' perspective. So maybe we'll just jump right in and I'll ask you, maybe you can think of a few, maybe three or four of the biggest challenges or changes you feel that students face when transitioning from high school to post-secondary school program.
Yeah, so I guess certainly at Guelph, most of our students are moving away from home. We have about 85% of our new students live in residence.
Right.
So, you know, moving away from home, normal sort of what I call separation anxiety, you start to see they're leaving their friends, their families, which tend to be safety nets for them.
Sure.
And so we see for some students homesickness, some students real anxiety about making new friends, you know, figuring out where they're going to eat and having someone to walk to class with, etc.
Right.
We have some students moving from very small communities. The university is huge for them, and it can be, just the size can be overwhelming. And then, of course, international students, you know, come with, as well, cultural kind of issues. So all the kinds of separation and trying to get settled pieces that we see.
For sure.
Another big challenge and concern, of course, is the academics. I mean, universities are different than high school. Different approach to teaching and learning. They're, you know, not led as much. They have to take responsibility for whether they go to class, what they study, when they study, et cetera. And, you know, I think they worry about those first exams and will they do well. You know, they hear that grades drop and that makes them quite anxious. So certainly when we start to move into midterm period, we see a lot of anxiety about those first exams and how they're going to do.
And is it true that grades typically drop?
Yeah, grades always drop. And, you know, I try and reinforce this all the time. Grades tend to drop, you know, 10 to 15%. But you remember cutoffs at Guelph are, you know, low 80s. Like, the grade drops don't bring you into a failure perspective.
Right.
But it can be a shock for students, particularly, interestingly, it's the very high students, the, you know, 90%ers who've always been 90%ers,
right.
We'll see them really struggling over, well, they only got an 81.
Right.
And, you know, we really also reinforce to parents that grades drop, and if your student's grade drops, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're, you know, they've been partying too much.
Right.
It's to be expected. Because
right.
It's a transition on how to study differently, testing differently, not as much memorization, it's more problem solving. So there's an adjustment period. Grades go back up.
Right.
Never quite as high as they were in high school, but it's that transition period, and then that can cause all sorts of stress. You know, writing those first exams and then getting those grades back becomes a bit creates some anxiety.
So adjusting one's expectations is an important
right.
consideration.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we tell students, I mean, every university tells students that grades will drop. But what they hear often is other students' grades will drop, right? Because I've always been an A student.
Right.
It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen to me.
Right. I'm going to study hard. And so expectations are important.
Right. Doesn't mean that you're doing worse. It's just that, as you said, all the other factors.
Absolutely.
You mentioned the separation anxiety, and I'm sure that's huge, especially, as you said, for students that are living away from home, maybe even for the first time leaving home for any length of time. Like, how long is there a kind of a transitional period that you see, like, after a period of time, if a student is extremely homesick or feeling very anxious, do you tend to say this tends to be a little bit more than the average student takes to adjust?
Right. I mean, I think it depends on the student, right? So, you know, some students, they're homesick for the first... Some students never get homesick. You know, my son went off to university. I didn't hear from him for the first week. I thought, where are you?
Right.
You know, I aren't you missing your mom? Like, don't you want to phone your mom? Right?
But if I could...
And I think some students really struggle. We have students who actually go home, right?
They leave
you
to
know,
go... They leave
we
to...
always... Thanksgiving... We always say Thanksgiving's a big time. Students go home and it's a reflecting time, right? And, you know, I would say if by Thanksgiving students are still in that not being able to cope because they're so sad, you know, really, really, you know, can't kind of get past that being away from family, that's when we would start to say, you know, that's a long time, right? You know, you're going to have periods of homesickness through your whole year, right? There's going to be times, birthdays or, you know, family times that you usually get together. You know, some students, the family always had dinner Friday night, so the odd Friday night they might get down. But if they're seriously really not coping, you know, I would say by Thanksgiving, you know, we often see students, not many, but the odd student won't come back at that point.
Right. Right? Yeah, and so you're saying a typical time would be about 2 months.
I think we normally see within a couple of weeks students start to settle, you know, those who are homesick. And we spend a lot of time trying to get students engaged. It's important, you know, to give them something that they can connect with, whether it's a club or whether it's, you know, an intramural sport or whether, like, trying to sort of find ways to engage them and to connect them with students. So, you know, people say, well, why do you do all that orientation? You know, it looks like it's a lot of games, and part of it is games, and part of it is to try and get students to connect with other students. Because if you find support systems where you can, you know, go and talk to someone or engage in a club, et cetera, it helps with that transition period, right?
Right. And you mentioned, you know, you mentioned that your son went away and you didn't hear from him during the first week. But I'm imagining that that first week, as you said, is, you know, it's a lot of fun. I don't know if every university refer to it as Frosh Week? Is that?
Hopefully no university refers to it as Frosh Week.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
you say that they don't.
The reason why is that Frosh Week has a kind of a connotation from some of the movies as being, you know, you all come to university and you drink.
Right.
And, I mean, that's not what we do at orientation.
So what's it called? Is it a defined orientation week?
Yeah, so we call it orientation week. You might hear it called O Week, right?
Okay.
In some places. Some universities might call it first year students week or, but, you know, it's a combination of social opportunities. You know, we do, we run practice classes so they can see what and give them tips on how to take notes. We introduce them to their program counselors and understand their academic requirements. You know, we do formal welcomes. So it's a mix of social and academic kind of preparation.
Prepared, yeah. So just to go back to what I was saying in terms of, you know, your son didn't contact you during that first orientation week, but I'm thinking that that first week might be very exciting for a lot of students.
And busy, yes.
And would you agree that maybe that homesickness or those pangs of whatever those feelings are may actually hit them after that?
Mm-hmm. And again, it depends on the student, right?
Right,
some
right.
students, you know, you watch the parents leave and they are already homesick. And what we do with the residence life staff is to make sure they get out, right? Because none of these things are mandatory. So if they don't engage, if they go to their room and you know, close that door, and they could be homesick right away and not engage. other students, absolutely, that first week we keep them busy, then classes start.
Right.
And then the reality of, okay, I'm here for a while, and these are the classes, and ooh, I don't know if I like this class. And so then you start to say, where would you normally go to have those discussions? For some students, it might be their parents or their brother or their best friend, and they're not there. And so it's being able to provide them with alternate kind of places to go. Sure. That helps ease that anxiety.
And so I'm thinking also beyond the anxiety or the homesickness, I would imagine that for many students, this is the first time or one of the first times that they've had to be this independent.
Yeah.
In terms of getting themselves up in the morning.
Yeah.
Or
and making that's the third. You know, when you talk about what are the big three, you know,
yeah.
I would say, you know, transition, home, sickness, getting connected. The second is the academic, like really worrying in a different way. And then the final is, you know, you really are now independent, right?
Right.
So there's no one there to say, get up and go to class. There's no one saying, did you go to class? There's no one saying, hey, did you study tonight? Or maybe you shouldn't go out, maybe you should study.
Right.
And the thing about university is that there's always opportunities to do other things, right?
Right.
I mean, it's just rich with, you know, things going on all the time. And
right.
So your students have to learn pretty quickly how to balance that social engagement versus academic side of the house. And the semester system is very quick. You know, those first set of exams come quickly.
Right.
And so some students struggle with that piece, you know. Gee, I didn't go to class the first 3 weeks. Now I haven't read anything. You know, now I'm in trouble. And so you see that adjustment too. And usually it's the first set of midterms where we start to see them shifting gears a little bit.
So for those parents who have, you know, a year or two to go before their student enters into post-secondary program, is there anything that they can be doing even the year prior, like the grade 12 year,
yeah,
in terms of preparing their child for life after high school?
Yeah, part of it is, you know, I'm a parent of millennials, and you know, we are known for being too involved and in doing too much for our youngsters. And haven't helped them develop some of their resiliency skills and independent skills, right?
Right.
So one of the things I would urge parents to do is, rather than, you know, be engaging all the time, start to get them to develop their own independence and actually make a few mistakes and learn from it. So, you know, rather than the last year in grade 12, waking up your son or daughter every morning and getting them breakfast, say, you know what, time for you to prepare on your own. Set your own alarm, you know, get your own breakfast, get off to school on your own. If you don't wake up, you sleep in, you know, I'm going to let you do that once or twice.
Right.
You learn, gee. You know, the same thing with studying. Rather than sort of saying, okay, tonight I want you to sit down in the dining room for 2 hours, you can't do anything.
Right.
Instead, say, okay, you know, at the start of the year, how are you going to set up a study schedule? What does that look like, et cetera? But then let them do a little bit on their own, right?
Right.
You know, I mean, grade 12 is an important year for grades, and so it'll be, you'll want to get back and push them a little bit. But I think that piece of getting them to set up their own regular schedules is really helpful for university. So if they get into the pattern of doing that, you know, always between 7 and 9, that's my study time, I'm going to find a study place, you know, and you sort of help them with that, but then stay out of their face for a bit.
Right.
That's really healthy to prepare them.
And just to add, perhaps, that, you know, I think that for many children whose parents who have been very involved in those kinds of activities might perceive their parents pulling back as a punishment, or, you know, you don't care about me anymore. But I think if the parent presents it to them in a very kind of logical manner, such as, you know, I'm doing this not because I don't want to help you, but because I actually want to help you
right.
prepare for a university or going away. And so this can be kind of our test year or our trial year.
Mm-hmm.
I think if they present it that way, then it doesn't come across as, you know, all of a sudden pulling away, like, where have you gone, mom, you know?
Right.
But it's done very, you know, more rationally and logically, so, you know, talked out.
Right. I think the other thing that I would love parents to do before they come is to have some discussions with young people about two things. One, alcohol.
Right.
You know, the reality is, you know, when almost every student who comes to university is underage.
Right.
But, you know, we know students can find alcohol anywhere.
Right.
And I think a really frank discussion around responsible drinking, around not everyone drinks. You know, there's this perception that once you get to university, you have to drink.
Right.
You know, a quarter of our students don't drink at all, right?
Right.
You know, and very few, it's actually not the norm to do this excessive kind of drinking. But, you know, having parents have that discussion about how do you say no? How do you say, you know, I'm not comfortable doing that? Like, giving them some of those skills, I think, is very helpful.
For sure.
You know, and I think that discussion often doesn't happen, and that should be happening. In grade 12, you should be starting to have those discussions around, you know, giving students the skills to be able to manage what they want to do rather than be part of a peer kind of pressure, right?
So again, not saying don't drink,
right?
Because as you said, they're going to, if you pressure them not to drink, they may even be, it may be even more enticing for them. But as you said, what I think is really great, what you said, is that, you know, teaching them how to respond and how to say no if they're not comfortable with it, or how to know their limitations, as opposed to preaching at them, but just asking them questions that can help you understand how much they know too.
Right. And I really would appreciate, you know, we try and dispel the myth all the time that everyone in university first year, it's a rite of passage to drink a lot, and that's just not true. And we don't see that on our campus at all. But we do see some students coming to campus thinking that that's the case, and that that's what they're going to do. And just really having that frank discussion about, you know, not everyone drinks, and it's okay to say no. And it's, you know, it's good to be able to have your own self ability to do that.
Right.
And then if you are going to drink, you know, really responsible drinking, right? Because it's so easy. There's no one there now, right?
Right.
And so, you know, you need to be cautious about that piece.
And actually,
and the other one, of course, is sexual violence, you know, and sexual assault. And, you know, just spending some time talking about consent, both girls and boys, you know, young men and young women, what does it mean? You know, you're now, you know, you have your own residence room. There's a lot of students living off campus. You know, you're no longer at mom and dad's house, right?
Right.
And so, you know, really engaging in those discussions around how to, again, you know, if you're either a young man or a young woman, you know, sexual activity, what that looks like, what the risks are, alcohol and sexual activity. I mean, I think it's important to have those frank discussions before they come, you know. Because, you know, parents are very important role models and mentors for their young people.
Right.
And you want to keep those lines of communication open. So, you know, having some of those discussions beforehand would be great.
And I think if parents are uncomfortable with that, you know, getting support from a therapist or somebody who knows the topic might be helpful before they even talk to their young people, because I think that many parents don't know how to even broach the topics.
Start those discussions, right?
Yeah. And I'm really hoping, as you said, that those topics are even discussed, you know, prior, like a long time prior to university if possible, because I'm thinking that you know, those students that have been, you know, parented in a very, very strict way might see university as an opportunity to really go a little bit wild for a while.
I don't, you know, it's funny. It's often not parenting in a strict way. It's parenting in a protected way, right?
Okay.
I think that, you know, as millennial parents, we have protected our young people, right? And so we make sure they're safe, and we've intervened a lot. And so, you know, what we really want is for students to be coming who've not been protected. I don't let them live, et cetera. But, you know, helping them to develop, to make their own decisions and understand the consequences of those decisions, and sort of, you know, putting those kinds of skills, giving them those kinds of skills is really helpful.
Yeah, so not what to think, but how to think.
Yeah.
You talked about alcohol and sexual behavior. I'm presuming that drugs would be in the same category as alcohol.
Yeah.
And what about, I mean, I don't know if this is a whole other topic, but what about cell phones? I mean, do you find that cell phones are an interference in academics even?
Yeah. You know, I encourage, it's a losing art. Certainly, you know, with my own two, I sort of said to them, don't take your cell phone into class, right?
Right.
You know, leave it in your knapsack. It's too much of a distraction, right? You know, I teach courses and You'll see students checking their phones or checking their computers. You know, it's just the nature of this group.
Right.
Where, for me, the technology is both a benefit and a curse, right?
Right.
It actually does connect young people. You know, they're connected, but it connects in a funny way, right?
Yeah.
So certainly in residence, you know, we have examples of students, you know, texting each other, and they live right beside each other.
Right.
Right. You
right.
know, we'll just go over and say hello.
Right.
So we try and really push the connecting person to person, not technology.
Right.
But the other piece, absolutely a distraction. You know, one of the things we'll always say in the orientation, don't take your cell phone to class. And the other thing is real opportunities for, you know, getting engaged in some unhealthy online activity.
Right.
I mean, there's just everything out there, right? So, you know, wanting students to understand what they post has implications and what they're reading. If they read things that are inappropriate, how should they be reporting, et cetera. So, yeah, we spend a lot of time on IT technology stuff.
Yeah, because I think, you know, it's a great thing to say, don't take your cell phones to class, as I say to my high school student, but, you know, and as good as she, and as,
yeah.
you know, cooperative as she is, I know that she still takes her cell phone to class
yeah.
because
but
it's
mine.
yeah, I mean, it's part of their arms, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But again, this is part of parenting, right? Parenting
yeah.
is to provide advice, et cetera. But at the same time, you know, you recognize that once they go to university, you're not there.
Right.
And so at some point you have to say, I've done what I can, I've given the information I can.
Right.
And, you know, maybe they'll hear it in their head at times.
Exactly.
But, you know, the reality is once they come to university, they will do what they're going to do. So it's more spending time talking about why that would be helpful and what that would look like rather than, you know, forcing it and taking the phone away, because they're going to, when they get here, unless they don't come with a phone,
right,
they're going to have their phone, right?
Right, exactly, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So once students, I mean, I think I want to stress that, as you said, that even if the homesickness becomes lesser after a period of a couple of months, there still might be times, you know, at a birthday or some significant event, that they might still feel little pangs, and that's normal. Maybe even as they return to second or third or fourth year after the
yeah.
summer back at home, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a like a different kind of period of adjustment.
Yeah.
After the first year is probably the most difficult. But the years that follow, there's probably some level of adjustment as they go from the summer back to school, I would imagine, right?
Mm-hmm.
But once they're more or less settled in, let's say they're more settled in than not, what kinds of things, like what do you see students, like what's after that period of transition? What are they, how do you see them blossom? Like what do you see the benefits of post-secondary education or living away from home?
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I was just talking about this with our residents life staff and sort of saying, you know, one of the most, you know, uplifting kind of parts of my job is to watch students develop. You know, I think that, you know, young people, they become, you know, they start to blossom in their classes and they find that niche. You know, the first year is a lot of general stuff and you often don't see them, you know, as excited. But once they get into their second, third, fourth year, you start to have them, you know, they're engaging you with conversations and, you know, things they see wrong with the world. And, you know, their education is helping them to think about where they might go and how they might engage in those things. You start to see them, you know, connecting with clubs or student governments, you know, that are also engaging in activity and starting to take leadership roles. You know, we have students, you know, going to build homes, and we have students, you know, advocating for supporting, you know, marginalized groups. We have, you know, you start to see students starting to see that they actually can be engaged in some of these issues. And part of that comes from their classes.
Right.
Part of it comes from engaging in extracurricular, you know, co-curricular activities. I always encourage students to also balance with some co-curricular, right? And so you start to see them, you know, and working with friends and really growing and becoming so mature. And, you know, I watched my own, you know, daughter and my son, we now have really great and intellectual and thoughtful debates about world issues.
Right.
You know, we never did that.
Right.
Coming out of high school, right? And so you really start to see that that development and that growth.
Do you think that there is benefit to kids living away from home at university, or like does it depend on the kid?
So I do, but you know, that's a personal thing. I think the one thing I worry, the thing about commuter students who don't live away from home, is they are less likely to get connected,
right?
So one of the things about residents and residence life staff, it's, you know, those eyes and ears and saying, you know, you don't seem happy. What are your interests? Oh, there's a club for that. Or, oh, you know, have you met so-and-so down the road? He's also doing those types of things, et cetera. That's a very deliberate way to connect. We find that commuter students, and we have quite a few commuter students, we have to work harder to connect them. They're more likely to come to class and go home.
Right.
And some of the real growth and the personal growth doesn't happen in the classroom. It happens in the having to make those decisions for yourself, having to, you know, decide, you know, what you do, getting involved in a club on campus. And it doesn't happen as much with the commuters. So, you know, and you know, our retention surveys show that students who live in residence for that first year do tend to more likely to graduate than those who don't.
Okay. And you talked about identifying students as maybe needing to be more connected. How do you identify it? Are there certain people that are kind of looking out for students who maybe, you know?
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways. You know, certainly in residence, we have residence life staff who live in residence with the students. And, you know, they might notice just that, you know, one student isn't engaging, isn't coming to house meetings, or it doesn't seem to be, you know, it seems to be on their own, you know, going and get food, coming back to their room, or those types of things. So
right.
They're deliberately watching for that kind of thing and trying to engage them. We then, we will, after the first set of midterms, identify students who didn't do well. And, you know, someone will, you know, give them a call or touch base and say, hey, not the end of the world. You know, lots of people don't do well their first midterms. Like, what can we do to help? We have a learning commons. We have supported learning groups. We have, you know, so starting to touch that piece. And sometimes, you know, we find that students, they're in the wrong program, you know, that they're in a major that's actually not their area of strength. And, you know, sometimes it's because of parental pressure. Sometimes it's school pressure or friend pressure. And so working with them to say, why don't you try some different courses in the winter, et cetera. So just, you know, having a number of places where we can identify where someone might be running into some difficulty.
It sounds like you have some great resources at the University of Guelph, but does your university stand apart, or do you think that most universities in Canada, for example, have similar resources available to the students?
Yeah, I think all universities have extraordinary resources, right? And I think that, you know, in my profession, we spend a lot of time talking about the transition of the first-year students. Most will have first-year programs in terms of intervention programs, support programs. Certainly the residentially intensive universities will have full counseling units. You know, we have multi-phase units, support networks, peer helper programs. I mean, that's pretty consistent.
Standard.
I think that more residentially intensive universities tend to just have more of that because students are living on your campus, and so you really want to make sure they're being well supported.
So what I'm hearing, if I'm correct, is other than the resources and the clubs and the committees and those kinds of things, you also offer counseling to those students who may be emotionally having a difficult time.
Yeah, we have full counseling, we have full health services, we have, you know, helplines, we have, and I think that, you know, we really work to say, you know, what you want to do is to make sure students don't get to the point where they need that.
Right.
So a lot of intervention early, but certainly we have support to students who are really struggling.
So as a parent listening to you speak, you know, it's making me feel really reassured because it's making me feel like it's like a little bit a large community
right.
with a lot of resources in place, you know, and sending my daughter away to university for the first time makes me feel more reassured knowing that there are so many services available. So that's great. But as a parent, you know, I know we've talked about what parents can do prior to their children leaving, but can you just comment on, you know, some of the do's and don'ts for parents when their children are actually there?
Yeah. So I think a couple of things. One, you know, parents are an important resource for students, and so usually a university will have a parent's website or a parent's newsletter or something like that. I encourage parents to read it. Usually those sites will tell them what resources are available, et cetera. And you know, I would say stay connected with your student and listen to them and say, you know, well, your homesickness, you know, have you tried to connect with clubs? Have you tried to connect with people? You know, maybe you should talk to your residence life manager, like sort of whatever those resources that you read about, mm-hmm. encourage them to engage. Encourage them to do that. You know, it's hard for a parent if their student is phoning home crying, I hate it here, I want to come home. We encourage parents to say, you know, this is normal, you know, give it a try, right? You know, talk to your RA, residence life staff, find out, you know, other places you can go, et cetera. So for that first little bit, encourage. If they're struggling academically, say, oh, I looked on the website, there's a Learning Commons, have you gone there? Like, encourage them to seek help. What we really encourage parents not to do is to phone us to say, you know, my daughter, like for your, my daughter, didn't do well in her exams. Can you please, you know, put her into a supported learning group, right? Because part of it is about them developing their independence to do it themselves, to advocate for themselves.
Right.
We do say, though, to parents, if you are really concerned about the mental well-being of your student, please let us know. Right?
Yeah, so it depends on the...
We never go so far as to say, don't intervene if they're really in trouble, because, you know, we will follow up.
Right.
But it's more, stay connected, stay positive, let them know this is normal. You know, when their grades drop, please don't say, well, were you out partying? Or, you know, say, that's normal.
Yeah.
Or, you know, don't worry, you know, there's resources, and then refer. Refer, and help them to refer. So you could phone the next night. Did you go to the Learning Commons? You know, oh, really, honey, you should try it, right? I've heard it's really good.
Yeah.
That's what I encourage parents to do.
So in other words, don't get in the car and rush to pick them up.
That's right. And don't come pick them up and take them home right away.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Give them an opportunity to try to resolve it, because, as you said, it's learning skills for the rest of their life.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a struggle for many parents, especially even.
Oh, it is. Absolutely.
I mean, I know that's how the term helicopter parent was formed, was, you know, through parents wanting to be overly involved, you know, in post-secondary school. But I think that is a tough pill for a lot of parents to swallow, because all of a sudden no information will be released, and you know. So I guess that's part of, I mean, I think that as much as students, you know, struggle sometimes with the separation, parents are struggling almost as much or more than, because the child is out there maybe having a really good time, but the parents sitting at home worrying, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You don't stop worrying when they're gone, right?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
No.
But at least, as you said, if they're calling home happy, then you feel a lot better, because you take your cues from your child.
Right. Right.
Anything else that I haven't touched on that you think is important for either students or parents?
That's great. No. You know, the only thing I would say is exactly what you said. You know, it is a transition for the whole family. But, you know, it's been going on for years, and students succeed. There's going to be ups and downs. There's going to be tears and laughter. And, you know, it's just supporting your student as they go through that process.
They
come out amazing young people.
One last thing, you know, I'm thinking of the parents who are about to drive their students to school, for example. Any guidance in terms of, you know, first day kindergarten, they encourage parents to leave as quickly as possible. Do you have the same kind of guidance?
I would say, try not to cry until you're out of sight.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
I mean, I tried so hard, you know, my son, I said, I'm not going to cry. And so I got in the car and I just bawled.
Yeah.
You know, my daughter, I was better, right? And it's funny, the first is the hardest and the first and last are hard.
Yeah.
Sometimes the first is the last and sometimes in the middle. And the other thing I just say, you know, just be excited for them. You know, the way, the emotion that you convey will feed onto them, you know, and so it's more about, this is a great time, it's exciting for you, I'm so happy for you, I'm so excited for you. I think that's really helpful. That kind of attitude can really help to sort of temper some of the anxiety.
Well, thank you so much. I think, you know, hearing from your, you know, advice you know, just in terms of your years of expertise working at university, but also listening to how you felt as a parent, you know, will also comfort other parents to know that doesn't matter what you do, that it's normal to feel this way. And it's really, you know, it's wonderful, all the information that you've shared, you know, for the parents and students who are embarking on this anxiety provoking, but more importantly, you know, very exciting adventure in their lives. So thank you for participating in this podcast.
I'm happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
To see a full listing of all Help Me Sarah podcasts and to learn more about Brenda, visit the podcast section at www.helpmesarah.com. You can also subscribe to Help Me Sarah podcast on iTunes, subscribe to my Facebook page, which is Sarah Dimmerman Help Me Sarah, or visit me on Twitter at Help Me Sarah. Until next time.